This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. The sun is setting on a chemical widely used by fruit growers in Michigan and across North America. For decades, glutathione has been a weapon of choice for farmers who grow cherries, apples, and blueberries. But glutathione, sometimes referred to as AZM, is a nerve agent and is being phased out by the Environmental Protection Agency. Researchers have been looking high and low for a replacement, and more experiments will be conducted this summer throughout the Grand Traverse region. In 2007, Mark Whalen told cherry growers at a conference downstate, quote, "We don't have the tools today to allow you to survive." Mark is an entomologist at Michigan State University, and he joins us this morning to talk about how things are going in the quest for a replacement for glutathione. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. How are you?
Very well. How are you today?
Well, I'm here. It's a very busy time of year, you know.
We appreciate your time. And if any listeners wanted to get in, they could at 276-4500. Or 800-442-9422. Of course, we'd love to hear from cherry growers, but can't imagine too many of them are hanging out in their kitchens listening to their radios right about now. But you could call at 276-4500 or 800-442-9422. So, Mark, I pulled your quote there out of the fruit growers news. How do things look today?
Well, they're more complex, probably, because we have more tools to test. By that I mean new insecticides that the federal government has approved for use in stone fruit, cherries and peaches, and plums, but also in palm fruit, the apple, pear, quince group. So there are more tools to work with, but we have a real struggle to get these tested in ways that are meaningful to growers for them to adopt, because the time frame for this process is very compressed these days compared to what typically happened, say, before 1996.
What do you mean compressed?
What I mean is that there's very little time from the time something is approved by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the expected grower adoption window. In the past, the kind of chain of process would occur when a private sector industry company established a registration of a compound for control of insects or diseases in agriculture. And that compound then, after it was registered, and even in the process of becoming registered, it would be researched upon by any number of the 72 institutions in the United States of higher learning who have primary responsibility to agriculture and other primary industries in the nation. So these land-grant universities, like Michigan State University, have farms where these materials are tested, both biological, organic, or conventional materials. And usually that testing ran a 3 to 4 year course where it started out in very small plots or even in greenhouses or laboratories and then progressed through larger and larger trials until it was on farm with experimental use permits from the EPA. So we had a very good knowledge of how these compounds interacted and how they impacted natural enemies and pollinators and other things in our own ecosystems, because the growing cherries, for example, in Michigan is very different from the tip of Leelanau Peninsula to St. Joseph in southern Michigan, because the pests are different, the climate is reasonably different. There are a lot of different plants, et cetera, that harbor different pests. So it's a very complex process. And therefore, when today we have a situation where growers are really forced to change the use patterns of certain pesticides that they've relied on for a long time, we still have new products that are just coming on the market last year and this year, without going through that long small trial to large trial to on-farm trial and straight into production with the idea that they would displace tools that have been used for 30, 40 years.
Why would they go into production if nobody knows if they'll meet the needs of the growers who are going to lose the use of glutathione?
Because the focus really isn't on growers. The focus is on interest groups and what they want and how effective they are politically in getting what they desire in Washington.
But ultimately, if the growers don't buy a new chemical because it's not useful, then what would be the point of producing it?
Well, the issue isn't so much that. No chemical company is going to invest in the development of a new product if it's not going to have a marketplace. The point of it is, though, is that marketplace is huge, with hundreds and hundreds of crops and hundreds of target organisms involved. For example, you could build a pesticide that attack mosquitoes that transmit malaria. Very, very important pesticide. But that pesticide may have no relevance at all for cherries.
Okay, well, going back specifically to glutathione, when you're talking about survival at a conference in 2007, that suggests to me this is a very important chemical for the way orchards are run now. Tell us a little bit about how it's used and what problems will result when growers cannot use it.
Well, the organophosphates as a class have been used in the United States since the 1960s, and they became the stable insecticides for all kinds of specialty crops. And Michigan grows more specialty crops than any other state in the union, except perhaps Florida and Washington. So we're a very intense specialty crop state. And the unique thing about the organophosphates is that they were quick-acting and they dissipated rapidly in the environment and disappeared. Unlike the chemistries that we're forced to use today, which tend to stay around longer and may have impacts on pollinators and other things in the system. So the organophosphates were very well vetted over years and years, and they provided reliable control with no residues in the fruit at harvest for the most part. Or they were very, very, very low residues, parts per billion residues, whereas some of the newer compounds are leaving higher residues. And that's a big problem for the fruit industry, because what's happening in the international markets is that we're seeing in these recessionary times globally kind of a collapse of the cooperation in setting residue limits in exported products. So we have uncertainty there, and the industry has uncertainty, and things are compressed in such a time frame that a grower may take a bet on compound X as a replacement for those organophosphates, AZM or whatever, and then find out that in an export market in some other place, that they're not allowing the residues that are legal here or the residues that are legal in Canada or Europe. Even those residues are very, very well researched. Company or countries can choose to change their residue limits and thereby create huge economic impacts on our industries here in the United States. I know that's complicated, and I'm sorry for that long explanation, but that's where we're at.
Is that to say then that the primary obstacle in finding a replacement for this is the residue in the fruit when it goes to market at the end of the season?
Well, there's very, very, very low residue in anything that we produce, especially in cherries, because they're harvested directly into water, and the pesticides that we use on cherries are fairly infrequent in application, et cetera. So it's very hard for somebody to imagine, but if you made a comparison to Lake Michigan, for example, you might be talking about a bathtub of water and all that whole massive trillions of gallons of water out there when you talked about residues in food. They're very, very low. So, but the issue isn't so much that, it's the trade game. what's going on in nations as they protect their producers and try to make viable markets for their own products. So it's more of a political game than a science game, and we get caught in that process. So that's what I'm talking about. But there are other issues too, and the other issues are that many of the newer compounds are not as effective as the organophosphates are. So growers have to have much more precision in how they use them in order to affect control. And nobody wants to eat red cherry with a white worm in it.
And the I gathered that the main pest that growers have in view when they apply glutathione is called plum curculio?
Well, that's one of them.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's a very interesting bug. It's fairly unique to pretty much the northeastern part of the U.S. We have a kissing cousin of a curculio called the plum curculio that occurs in from the Shenandoah Valley all the way down into northern Georgia and central Georgia, where they produce lots of peaches as well. Well, these insects are kissing cousins, and they have a unique biology. In fact, in the Laura Ingalls Wilder series, I think on the banks of Plum Creek or on Silver Lake, one of those books in the series, there's a description of the plum curculio in there. It's a very accurate description. Laura and Mary are sitting on the banks of Plum Creek, and they're looking at these wild plums. They're Prunus americana, a wild plum that occurs all the way out from the east coast to the west. And but this beetle only occupies territory out into the eastern Dakotas. Well, they're right on the eastern Dakotas, South Dakota, and they're sitting on the ground, and these plums are just starting to set fruit, and they see what Laura describes as an industrious small dark beetle crawling very rapidly around and stinging the fruit with a moon-shaped scar. And she describes this to Mary, as Mary is blind by that time from an infection she had. And that's a very accurate description of the plum curculio. It occurs in all kinds of plants all over Michigan, but it loves tree fruit in the early spring. So it migrates significant distances into the edges of orchards and begins to sting fruit about right now for cherry producers. And it lays an egg in there, and then that egg develops into a white worm, and eventually it's a pretty large white worm. And then when you come and harvest the cherries, those white worms are in the cherries, and you harvest them into water, and the water's cold, and so they just sit there. They're alive. And if you eat those fresh cherries and take a bite in one of those, and it tastes a little odd, and you spit it out into your hand, and there's this wiggly white worm in there, you got a plum curculio. And that's not very attractive for the marketplace. So we had a law passed in this state in the early 19th century, in the 1920s, that banned white worms and red cherries for the state to protect that industry and its reputation in the marketplace. Since that time, we've got USDA standards of purity that restrict growers, and they can only have parts per million of these white grubs in any product that they have. And in truth, I mean, I'm a scientist, and I've worked a lot in stored product pest management, and we eat bugs every day, but we don't know it, or pieces of them, because they're ubiquitous in our systems. When you can see one, then people reject that, and processors get in trouble, and growers eventually have to pay the price. So growers want to produce as healthy and pure and without bugs cherries as they can. That's the struggle.
So tell us a little bit about what has happened in sections of orchards. I think growers refer to these as blocks, where experiments have been done and no glutathione has been used. Tell us a little bit about the range of what's happened there.
Well, we have a number of growers. I think they're heroes, actually. We have 9 different growers in the state who are participating with Michigan State University with a federal grant from the USDA to research ways of controlling these white grubs and red cherries. And we're doing that by trying to incorporate the safest biological means that we can. So we've actually invested thousands and thousands of dollars of researching this little bug, finding out where it goes in the winter, where it lives in the summer, how it flies, where it moves, when does it mate. And the truth is that because glutathione was so powerful, the organophosphates as an insecticide were so powerful, that there was never really a real need to learn the biology of this little pest. So we've learned in the last 8 to 10 years volumes about this, and we've published these things and taught growers about them, and it's a big aha, because there are millions and millions of species of insects out there. They're the most abundant species on Earth, estimated as high as 10 million species when we have, say, 250,000 species of plants and about that same number of animal species on Earth. Insects, we don't even know how many species there are, and nobody was really paying attention much to this little beetle that laid eggs in cherries and other stone fruits and apples. So this project was funded by USDA. It brought together some of the best researchers in the U.S. in cherries, and we have been trying for the past 6 years to develop systems that manage this beetle and other pests, not just this beetle, but other pests, in the system that are unique, pretty unique to cherries, and develop a system to sustain and keep alive an important industry up the west coast of Michigan, particularly in the Traverse area. So this project has been going on farm with large blocks. These growers are donating 20 acres of cherries and risking those cherries in the process. I mean, that's thousands and thousands of dollars they're risking to help us try to find a cure for this, or try to find a way around it. And we've been working diligently, literally year-round. We've been able to culture this beetle by some tricks of biology. And so we've learned a lot about its biology and how it reproduces and how many eggs it produces, and even the phenology, the temperature relationship in when it flies and when it lays eggs and things like that. So we can very precisely now time insecticides. So growers don't have to spray the whole season. They only have to spray very precisely, maybe once or even one and a half times a season to get control of this. But one of the things that's happened in the process is that glutathione was very, very cheap, compared to these newer compounds. They're very expensive, and they don't have as broad a spectrum. That is, they don't kill as many different bugs at the same time. So you have to have kind of like this a very precise tool placed at this time of the season, then followed by another precise tool, followed by another precise tool, each of those adding up to 3 or 4 or 10 times more expensive than it was to produce cherries before. As a result of that, cherry growers are really in a bind. They want to produce this very high-quality product, and there is an expectation on the part of the public that they would do that, and yet their costs are escalating tremendously to be able to do it.
And when you say, Mark,
the government has invested in MSU to figure out the biology of this thing and when these new tools could be used.
And Mark, so when you say 3 or 4...
Bug, and basically... trying to disrupt its biology. For instance, even after harvest, we can come in with what's called an insect growth regulator, a very, very low dosage material in an orchard, and it has no target site in humans. That is, you can eat it for breakfast, and it doesn't have any place to go but through you, because there's no binding site in the human body for it. And we can put this on at a very low rate in the orchard, and it bumps these pests into thinking it's spring. So they say, oh, my word, it's spring. Let's mate. Let's have fun. So they mate, and then, you know what? The cherries aren't there. They're harvested. They don't have anything to eat. So they fly out of the orchards in search of stuff to eat, and because they think it's spring and they're physiologically committed to spring, when fall comes and winter comes, they've used up all their fat body and they can't overwinter and they die. So the next year we have much reduced population. So those are the kinds of tricks we're trying to play. And those systems are really very safe to pollinators and other birds, et cetera, because they don't have receptors either for these compounds.
Mark, and I want to back up. I want to, Mark,
the kind of strategy that we're trying to do. Others are that we're using actually organic biological materials, fungi and nematodes, to spray on the soil-dwelling stages of these organisms, which actually augment the soils in orchards. But these specific little fungi and nematodes, not even putting any kind of residue on cherries, to attack the soil-dwelling stages of the beetle and essentially biologically control it. But it takes very precise systems, and you have to irrigate the understory of the orchard to get them to effectively cause disease in the soil-dwelling stages of this beetle. So those are just two examples of what we're trying to do and what has happened. And it takes a while for growers to adapt to the precision and the scope and the difficulty of such a challenge compared to loading up a sprayer and taking it out in an orchard and just spraying it. So growers are having to go to school again in big time to be able to manage this pest.
When you say the costs go up three, fourfold, do you mean the overall cost of producing a tart cherry or the cost of the pest management?
Oh, the material cost for the pest management material. For example, Metarhizium anisolpi, which is a fungi to control Plum curculio in the soil, cost as much as 10x what a grower would have to use glutathione in the tree. But that's just the cost of the material. It's much more expensive to put it on. It's much more expensive to maintain it because you have to irrigate the orchard to keep it moist for that fungus to live. And you have to put a lot more on in the ground cover because the beetles are not aggregated in the tree around the cherries. So you used to use the cherry as the bait and make the poison on the outside of the cherry so when they fed on it or touched it, they would die. But now we're having to use a lot more material, more frequent applications, much more expensive material, very limited in their impact on the environment, even beneficial. But the cost to the grower overall compared to what it would be to put on a single spray of glutathione and solve all this problem simply, the cost of the grower might actually be 25% overall production cost increase.
So, Mark, I only have a couple minutes left here, but what the scenario you're painting suggests that if glutathione was if this season had been the first season in which growers had to go without it, we would have an explosion of costs and very erratic results in the orchards. So, what is a reasonable expectation for what will happen when it is phased out in 2012?
Well, we have a huge education job to do, and growers throughout the industry are trying to adapt even now. But one of the things that's true about the cherry industry in particular, you're talking about a bunch of sharp cookies. These people know what they're doing. These people are highly educated. These people, many of them, have master's degrees. There are a lot of cherry growers who have come through Michigan State University, through horticulture, or one of the other departments here. These are educated people and business people. They understand what needs to be done, so they are paying attention. I'll bet you there isn't a cherry grower in the state who hasn't been to our educational programs over the last 2 years to get shaped up to make this transition. One of the big questions for them, though, is that can they sustain with the price of cherries the way it is today, can they sustain their operations and actually stay in business because of these cost increases, which are mitigated through the federal government, but the government doesn't ensure that they will get a higher cost or a higher price for their product. So this opens us up to international trade from other nations impacting us very significantly. So essentially putting our growers out of business indirectly because we can't compete with people who can still use glutathione overseas with no residues on their fruit and ship it in here.
And just very quickly, I thought that Canada had phased it out already in 07. Is that correct?
Yeah, but Canada hardly grows any cherries.
I see.
They're not a competitor with us. We export to Canada hugely. It's a big market for us. I mean, there's only a little bit of a peninsula just north of Detroit that produces any cherries at all in Canada. It's not even, it's insignificant compared to what Michigan is producing.
All right. Well, Mark Whalen, thanks for your time.
Okay.
We'll catch up with you again in the future.
Bye.
Mark Whalen is an entomologist at Michigan State University. This is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. Last month, the governor of Michigan hailed the creation of new jobs in Manistee building wind turbines. The Windspire is the product of Mariah Power, based in Nevada. It's a turbine made for homeowners. It spins on a vertical axis, which means it looks like a spinning cylinder. People like the governor say Michigan's future economy will be built on manufacturing renewable energy equipment, just like the Windspire. Unfortunately, the Windspire did not get such glowing reviews from scientists who test these devices at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado. The Windspire's test ended early this winter after equipment failures. Ian Wolfenden is a senior editor at Home Power magazine. He says even though the Renewable Energy Laboratory has not released a full report about the study, it has posted information online about numerous problems the Windspire had during testing.
I happened to visit the testing center last summer and saw the turbine not up, not running, and the staff there were not forthcoming about exactly what was happening with it, but then they did abruptly terminate the testing. When you look at the production numbers, they're miserable. We're showing it was in testing for about 8 months. It generated 108 kilowatt hours. In Michigan terms, I don't know exactly what your utility rate is, but perhaps 20 cents a kilowatt hour. You know, that's $20 of electricity that it made in an 8 month test.
And, actually, the retail price of energy in Michigan is a little more than 8 cents an hour.
Yeah, so there you go. So 108 times 0.08, I was trying to be generous. You know, it's $8.64 worth of electricity that it generated in its test on the NREL site, which is a fairly good site. The problem I see with this company is they're leading people to have expectations that are very high. And this is very, very common with venture capital companies. It's common with vertical axis wind turbines that they raise expectations and then the consumer buys into this thinking they're going to get cheaper electricity and cleaner electricity and they end up disappointed. And I would urge you and as a reporter and your listeners to probe into this and look at the actual cost of energy. The goal here is not to make a spinning sculpture. The goal is to make renewable kilowatt hours. And so we need to look at how many kilowatt hours does this machine actually make in a typical installation, and how much did it cost? And when I run the numbers on other such schemes, I find that, you know, customers end up paying 4 to 10 or 100 times as much for the electricity as if they just stayed with the utility. These sorts of companies tend to promote projects that are not in optimum situations. They're on a very, very short tower. And the reality of wind electricity, I mean, the physical reality is that we need high wind speeds. We need to be up above the obstructions. This particular company gives their rating at a 12-mile-per-hour average wind speed. And that's actually quite a high average wind speed. It's on the high end of what a typical home site would see on a tall tower, on a tower that's, you know, 50 or 100 feet above the houses and the trees. So giving a production prediction based on 12 miles per hour is very unrealistic for a turbine that sits on a 10-foot tower. And on their very website is pictured right next to trees and right next to houses. There just isn't very much of a wind resource in those situations. If we actually measured that resource, we might find that it's a 5 or a 6 mile per hour wind speed. And wind is wind power increases in a cubic function. So if we take 5 times 5 times 5, you know, we get 125 units. If we take 10 times 10 times 10, we get 1,000. That's 8 times the available power by doubling the average wind speed. So, you know, a 5-mile-per-average wind speed is one that we would rarely tap. We would rarely think it was worth it to invest in equipment to capture that energy. There just isn't very much energy there.
But having a wind turbine in a bad location is one thing. You're saying the winds in, is it Golden, Colorado, where the Windspire was tested, were pretty strong, and even out in good conditions, it produced very little energy.
You know, I'd be careful about making a conclusion there because I don't know the average wind speed on the Golden test site. And that's a piece of data that is not there in their report. And I'd like to find that out before I made a strong statement about that. And the report is riddled with problems with the machine. So, I mean, a machine that's broken is obviously, it doesn't matter what the wind resource is. So to be fair to the company, I'd like to see results on a real test where it was running the whole time and we know what the average wind speed is. But I can tell you that in general, this sort of design, this vertical axis sort of design, will not outperform what's already on the market. The horizontal axis, you know, what we call propeller-style turbines, these vertical machines will underperform compared to them with the same capture area, the same swept area. And I'd encourage you to look on the Internet for a document. If you Google an open letter to inventors, this is a document that my colleague Mick Sicrillo put together, which compiles the claims from these sorts of companies that are selling vertical axis machines, they're selling roof-mounted machines, they're selling machines on short towers, and they all have lots of similar hype, lots of similar marketing, and lots of similar ignoring of the physics and focusing on selling equipment instead of focusing on renewable kilowatt hours, which I think, you know, most of your listeners, their goal is to have cleaner, less expensive electricity. And that's not an easy job with wind. That's a very difficult job, especially with small wind. The smaller the turbine, the more difficult it is to make the economics play out. Utility scale wind, great stuff, you know, very economical, competes with non-renewables. But on the home scale, it's tough. It's a very difficult job to capture wind energy. And companies that make it sound easy are either clueless or they're trying to deceive someone. And, you know, you and your listeners will have to judge with this particular company, but I've seen marketing from them that's really quite deceptive. For instance, you know, the typical average wind speeds for a home scale site range from, let's say, 8 to 14, and 14 is an incredible site. I mean, very few people live in a home that has a 14 mile per hour average wind speed. Well, this company has had a chart on their website until recently that showed production up to 30 miles per hour average, which only happens on the top of Mount Washington, New Hampshire, for selected months. You know, it's a very, very rare wind resource, and no one lives with that. No wind farm lives with that. And that they were showing this energy production curve that went way up there to make it look very amazing. And again, I'm not specifically just trying to pick on this company. It's a pattern that we see in the industry. The new companies come in, they don't really necessarily do their homework about what has and hasn't worked before, and they come up with a product and they market it in a way that gives consumers an unrealistic expectation of what they'll actually get out of the product.
How well is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory doing at, you know, providing what everyone feels is good, objective information that, you know, we can base a discussion around?
I would say that's a little mixed. You know, we are, obviously, that's a government lab. It's funded by our tax dollars. But also you get companies that come in and hire them to do testing. And then there's a mix of government and private money. And I would say in those cases, the information is a little less forthcoming. In this particular case, I mean, I happen to know people at that lab, and I still don't have a clear answer of why this testing was terminated. I'm looking forward to asking those questions in person next month in Wisconsin at our WIND conference. But I would rather see more transparency there. This is our money being used to test products, and even if it is mixed with private money, we should have clear access to the information on a regular basis, on a daily basis. I'd like to just see what our money is being used for there.
And do we have any other evidence of the? I'm getting the sense from you that these vertical wind turbines, which is people could imagine is sort of a spinning cylinder as opposed to the propeller as you described it. Do we have any other evidence about how well this might work?
Well, there's a very long history with verticals. I mean, the Persians used verticals in 2,000 years ago. So it's not a new technology, and that's one of the things you'll find in that open letter I referred you to. The manufacturers and inventors of these say it's new, it's a great breakthrough. Well, a lot of these are very, very old, and many of these have been tried before in very similar configurations. And as one of the manufacturers of horizontals, propeller style, says, this is distracting our industry. It's not that you could not make a vertical to perform well, but there are inherent things in the design that lead me to conclude that it would be very unlikely that there would be a performance increase over what we have today. There are problems with fatigue, there are problems with startup, with shutdown, there are problems with bearings, with how to actually mount these turbines up on tall towers where they belong, where there is actually a wind resource. So if you look back at the history of our industry, you'll see these crop up regularly, and the companies stick around for a little while, and then they disappear as the public discovers, hey, this really isn't magic. It really is a hard job to capture wind energy, and I actually wish someone would make a successful vertical and market it honestly and say, hey, this needs to be on a tall tower. You're not going to get, incredible performance next to your house. It will need maintenance. It will be costly because right now the economics, with subsidized grid electricity, the economics are not always easy. You really need quite a good wind resource. You need a very reliable turbine, and you need incentives to make it pencil out financially. And the reliability is the number one thing. If a turbine that's lying on the ground or has broken parts is producing 0 kilowatt hours, and the payback is infinite. So we need to have reliable operating turbines. It doesn't matter if they're a big advance in efficiency. It doesn't matter if they're beautiful. It doesn't matter if the company is local. We need reliable equipment that keeps churning out kilowatt hours year after year after year to make a cost-effective renewable energy technology.
All right. Well, Ian, thanks for your time.
Appreciate it.
And Ian Wolfenden is a senior editor at Home Power magazine. This is Points North on Interlaken Public Radio. Tonight in Leland, the curious history of Empire's founding family will be dramatized in an original musical called What Do You Give? Written by Anne-Marie Oman, the play explores the lives of the Rowan brothers through recollections sparked by objects sold when the family's estate was liquidated in 1985. The two brothers left on the family homestead were found dead that year, apparently of natural causes. One of the men who found the bodies of the two brothers was David Trahorn. He was the mayor at the time and has gathered much of the history of the events surrounding this family. It was his historic research that first brought the story to the attention of the playwright. Trahorn says years before Ben and Andy Rowan were found dead, another brother, Sievert, disappeared without a trace.
Which is, you'd think a hunter or something would have found a skull or something, you know. The skull would be the only prominent thing. Other bones might be bones, but a skull would stick out pretty well. But so all kinds of speculation, nothing ever done beyond that. A seance was called in and thought Sievert was in the cistern, little tongue twister. But we did check the cistern. The sheriff department come out, and it's a big block tank underground out on the farm. And I've actually got pictures down inside the tank with one of the deputies. So no Sievert there. So
the sheriff's department followed a lead from a medium.
Yeah. Hilda Joy, a local resident, had this medium she knew that was just convinced that's where Sievert was. So there was a continued interest to look for him in that sense, you know, if there was a lead. But after normal exhaustion of normal leads, they just sort of let it die. And that was the last attempt to look for Sievert that I recall.
So this is a piece of history in Leelanau County that you've researched. You lived it,
yeah.
Recently you've been giving presentations on it. And so what is it, other than the kind of the mystery of it, that makes it remarkable and worth recalling and discussing?
In Empire's history, what started it was these five brothers' father, Andrew Rowan Sr., came here in 1892 to work for the Empire Lumber Company. He was a very enterprising guy, went back to Norway, got several family members. So they're a major part of the early Empire history, working for the Empire Lumber Company. And he settled a little village south of the mill on mill property where they built about a dozen homes called Norway Town. And the Andrews' house was the biggest, and they held church services there. They held dances there. So he was sort of an integral part. He was the head of the lumber pilers. The Empire was a hardwood mill where they got out wood for the Chicago market in the flooring business. So they tied in with the history of the village that way. And then by 1895 or 6, we know he was in the saloon business. And then when they closed the saloon in the 30s, all these parts were home on the farm. So between the local history of this family coming here in 1892 and having the complete turn-of-the-century saloon in their house, as we went through the house and photographed it, I realized that a lot of this stuff has to stay here somehow. We found two wills leaving everything to each brother, Andrew to Ben and Ben to Andy, and the second will leaving everything to the Empire Museum, of which Andy was a member, but neither will was signed. So then we knew we had to go fight for our fair share of this estate, you know, at a public auction or whatever. We assumed that's what was going to happen. So realizing the content of the house, I thought it was important historically for the village of Empire to get involved for sure.
Why? What was in there?
Oh, between all this wonderful saloon pieces, little things wouldn't mean much to outsiders, but one of the leather aprons that the lumber pilers used as they piled the lumber onto these boats so they wouldn't get full of slivers. We found two posters of a gal that came here and parachuted to her death in 1920. We never knew they existed before. Several postcards from different angles of the mill than we had ever seen before. Advertising for the saloon. Just several small items. And we knew we probably wouldn't be able to compete for many of the quality antiques, such as Norwegian trunks and pictures and frames and beautiful beer advertisements that brought hundreds and thousands of dollars. German toys and American toys too, but old wind-up toys. I mean, it was such a treasure trove. That's why the auction netted nearly $200,000. One item, a double Dewey slot machine, should have bought well over $20,000, but there was a little mix-up in the auction, and it ended up bringing up $18,500. Another slot machine bought $8,000. Beautiful coin-operated Regina music box. So a lot of nice stuff. I've collected antique sort of, so I can appreciate what was in there.
Okay, but you're saying in addition to a number of very valuable antiques, there were all these little remnants of Empire's history going back to its very foundation.
Right. So that was, and I started a separate box and just put on it in a magic marker for Empire Museum consideration. At that time, we just had a little old hose house building for a museum, 20 by 40. So obviously, as we got into this auction, things changed. But in the day before the auction, there was only three heirs. The oldest two brothers had been married, Al and Gilbert. Gilbert had two children, and Al had one child. And they're all at the auction. But the night before the auction, they released this little box of trinkets I mentioned, including the saloon license, this leather apron, these posters of Deborah de Costello. So, and then the first day of the auction, it had nearly 90,000, and Gary Hiltz, the fellow that found the bodies with me, suggested to Jack Rowan, one of the heirs, how about back in the museum tomorrow, up to 10,000 bucks so we can get some of the saloon and fixtures. So we had spent, I had went out and raised, on behalf of the museum, $5,000, and that's what the bar loan cost us. So then we spent $8,000 of the heirs' money the next day getting bar-related items to keep it in Empire. So it was quite an effort by local people and the heirs kicking in to keep this stuff in Empire.
But going back to the wills, you're saying there was a will there. Had it been signed, all this would have been the property of the museum.
Ironically, they left wills leaving stuff to each other, but they both died together. And then the second one leaving it to the museum, or the historical group, as we were called then. So it would have been quite different, but not to be. So we had to go compete with people from 26 states at this auction. It was a three-day event. Heritage group did borrow the Lions Club Grub Shack and made nearly $3,000 hawking hot dogs, chips, and coffee at the auction, so we had done pretty good there. So, and then, Paul, after we had all this stuff accumulated after the auction, we needed a piece of land. We knew we needed a new museum at that point. The Cherrywood Bar was as long as our museum building, practically. So we talked to Paul and Francis Johnson in Empire, donated a wonderful piece of land right in the village next to the fire hall, and we applied for and received a $100,000 grant from the Michigan Equity Grant Program through the assistance of then-Senator Connie Binsfeld. So we were off and running.
So the saloon, you're saying, going back to this saloon, this was run out of their home during Prohibition?
No, it was before that, 1896. Andy had been in business with two other people in 95 and 6, fellows by the name of Wise and one other fella. I've got most of the documentation because I've got a lot of the paperwork. So it was a separate building down in the village they had started. They had built their home after Norway Town. He built this beautiful farm home that's still there today where the boys lived, and that was also a boarding house. But the saloon was a separate building down in the village. It ran during Prohibition. One of the sons, Al, ran it. You see lots of orders for pops and cigars and that kind of stuff, so you know it was during Prohibition. And then they closed it up in the early 30s, it looks like, because the building was tore down in the late 30s. But when they closed it up, they took all the pieces home. Parts were upstairs, parts on the front porch, parts in a chicken coop, all over. And Andy had an interest in redoing this. They had a pole barn, but it wasn't high enough walls to put this bar up, which was 10 foot tall. And I remembered that when we got our grant and built our museum. I says, we must have a 10-foot ceiling. And the bar has less than a half an inch clearance in our new building with the tin ceiling we've recreated. So we've got a new, it's 20 years old now, we opened in 87, a 40 by 80 two-story building that houses the bar and all related items. And since then, we've added three more buildings. So for a little town of Empire, we've got quite a museum complex, partly initiated by the results of the Rowan story.
So have you seen the dramatization of this, or parts of it?
No, I'm not going till Friday night. I got the manuscript from Anne-Marie Ullman. She mentioned I could have a part in it or something, but which I had no interest in. It looks like, based loosely on the Rowan story, basically centered around the auction. And it's a musical. I just heard the little bit on public radio this morning. It sounds like good music. Anne-Marie Ullman and Norm Wheeler and Pat Nemesto and their crew. This will all benefit the Leland County Museum. Our museum's loaned them several items to embellish, including the Golden Eagle that we found. It was, I think, plays a major part in this story. So it should be fun. It'll recreate a little more interest in the whole Rowan saga. I do a slide presentation based on the photos I took when Gary Hiltz took the pictures, and we turned them into slides. And for the museum every year, I do either for Rotary, Lions Club, Huntington Bank, Daughters of the American Revolution, we do this Rowan Story presentation, and it always creates quite a lot of interest.
How much interest was there beyond the Grand Traverse region in this episode when it
occurred? Well, when it happened, when the two boys were found dead and the Enterprise came out, it says, cash-filled house full of antiques, and two boys missing, and or two boys found dead, and where's Sievert? There was an article in the Houston Chronicle, I recall, in the Tampa Tribune. So once it hits the AP wire, but that all, and there was a real big article in the Detroit Free Press, and then follow-up articles with the auction, quite a lot of interest.
And then the house was filled with cash as well?
We found $100,000 in cash after they removed the bodies. I was asked to be administrator because one of the three heirs is my mother's half-sister, or we call her my aunt, but the other heirs objected, so Empire Bank took over as administrator. But Gary Hiltz and I were sort of employed to go through the house looking for wills, and Jim Miranda from the Empire Bank sat at the living room table the first day and said, if you find anything interesting, bring it in. Of course, we found these unsigned wills, but then we started finding cash and Social Security envelopes in two very plain places, one in a glass cabinet, the other on a roll-top desk, and by lunchtime we had taken this cash to the bank, at Empire Bank, went over to the Friendly Tavern and had a hamburger. And when we come back, we found out we'd found in a neighborhood of $60,000 in cash, I think, in these Social Security envelopes. And they'd say $500 plus $200 minus $100 and had a little balance. They also had sold a piece of property to the National Park, a southern piece of their property, and they had $70,000 or $80,000 for that in the bank. So they had some money in the bank and much of it kept in cash. So it was quite a treasure hunt. It was quite a challenge.
Well, David, thanks for your time.
Okay.
David Trehorn is a local historian and resident of Empire. The musical What Do You Give?, loosely based on the lives of the Rowans in Empire, will be performed tonight at the Old Art Building in Leland at 7:30. Also tomorrow night at that time, there's a matinee on Sunday at 3. You can go to oldartbuilding.com for more about that. If you want to hear the report that Brad Aspie did on Interlochen Public Radio, you can go to ipr.interlochen.org. This has been Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. Thanks to Linda Steffen for helping me produce the show today. Jack Connors is our engineer. John Wunsch provided our theme. Tom Paulson is the general manager of Interlochen Public Radio. Have a great weekend.